Hello, Scene by Scene listeners. We apologize for any audio issues on this interview and promise to do better next time. Joe Zabel, welcome to Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean.
Well, thank you guys for inviting me.
Well, first I wanted to just try to set the clock back for all three of us for when we all connected with each other. And I think we first knew about Joe from a combination of seeing his credits in American Splendor, but then also you were writing reviews for Subliminal Tattoos, and we sent you copies of Keyhole Mini Comics along with our press release, which is funny because we made a press release for this podcast too. So it's obviously something we enjoy doing.
Yeah. You know, I'd always been very much interested in comics from the theoretical perspective and conceptually and stuff. And somehow the editor of Subliminal Tattoos thought of contacting me, and, you know, I jumped at the chance to do a review column. And, you know, I was really interested in covering the alternative comic scene in spite of what was out there. I thought it was undercovered, and, you know, I wanted to find little masterpieces like Keyhole that showed what was going on in the field.
Well, thank you for that. But that was such like a high time for the zine period and mini comics. And like that was like early to mid 90s was sort of like the hotbed of all that self-publishing stuff going on.
Yeah. And I had been involved in the zine scene for a very long time. Matter of fact, Bruce Chrislip is a friend of mine who wrote kind of a history of the mini comics, and he identified a comic I'd done as being one of the first examples of it.
Oh, really? What comic was that?
It was called Tales of the Enemy.
Oh. And it was a self-published mini or a zine or?
Yeah, it was a mini comic. It was in a, I guess you call it, digest zine format, and we just distributed it at Youngstown State University campus. We just printed them up at this place called the Newman Center, which was a Catholic social services center. I'm not Catholic. I just was exploiting them. So we distributed it free around the campus, and I helped get a lot of people locally in Youngstown really energized about comic.
That's so cool. So you're originally from Youngstown, Ohio.
Right.
And you moved to Cleveland like in your early 20s, and that's sort of when you hooked up with Harvey.
Probably was in my mid 30s or so. And yeah, that's when I met Harvey. And you guys saw that little one page comic I did about the story of me meeting Harvey.
Yes.
You know, involving, you know, getting to know Gary Dumb, who was, you know, at one of the best comic book shops at the time. And he introduced me to Harvey, and there was a $5 bill on the steps, and I asked Harvey if it was his, at which point it promptly disappeared into his pocket.
I love that story.
I love how he said, "I'll take care of that. Don't worry, it's in good hands. You don't have to worry about it." He probably paid you that same $5, you know, when you did your first page for him. So, you know.
Possibly. Page rates were just a little bit above that
exactly.
At the time, I think. So
I'm assuming from your background that you already were pretty familiar with American Splendor and Picard when this all happened.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't that familiar with it. I was very into the underground comics, but I don't think I'd actually seen an issue before I moved to Cleveland. Matter of fact, my first impression of American Splendor was that it was, you know, a sex comic. I mean, obviously, for somebody to use the pseudonym of Harvey, you know, Pecker, you know, it couldn't be anything but.
Oh my gosh, I never thought of that. That is amazing.
Yeah, me neither. Though, and actually, if you think about it, because it was probably sold where among other underground comics, you would presume it's got to be sexual in nature, right?
Yeah, and being really realistic and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
That is brilliant.
Wow.
Did you ever try to, you know, push him in that direction? You know, you're like, well, that's originally what I signed up for. And, you know, it's not really happening in these stories.
Well, certainly I did not. But, you know, you might be familiar with one of the early American Splendor artists, Greg Budget.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, he really aspired to be a good girl artist. And you can see some of his good girl proclivities in American Splendor, some of the stories he did. But
and it's funny, not to jump ahead, but to think about where you went after American Splendor with Trespassers, like you had inclinations of doing crime comics, just as like I was interested in doing superheroes, you know, but we all worked with Harvey, you know. And
well, I mean, you know, I love mystery stories, but it was a little bit more strategic than that. You know, I had developed a pretty realistic style working for American Splendor, which, I mean, my style was realistic to begin with, but, you know, I started to really, really appreciate the moment-to-moment type, real-time, real-life type of scenario. And I just thought that a mystery story would be a good way of exploiting that because of the fact that if you have an investigation into a mystery, that really involves looking at physical evidence, you know, what actually happened, you know, subtle keys in people's behavior and stuff. And so I just thought it was a good fit.
So American Splendor was like a good training ground, actually, because of the nuances of human nature and behavior that was able to transition into your mystery comics. Yeah. Now, you said that you moved to Cleveland. Did you read American Splendor, the comic, and did it give you a more of an insight to Cleveland, or was it accurate, or was it just Harvey's version, obviously? Like, how did you respond to the stories and the comic?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, I responded to the stories, you know, that I thought it was literature. And I just wanted to respond to the idea that it was training ground. You know, I have always thought of it as being more of like the privilege of getting to portray these stories and try to bring them to life and try to make literature out of them. So, yeah, there was a lot of training I had to go through to try to live up to those stories. But, you know, I viewed it as some of the most important work of my life. You know, I didn't think of it as just something to help my career along.
How much liberty did you take with the scripts?
Oh, an enormous amount of liberty. Let me answer that. But first, I wanted to get back to you asked, how does Harvey's version of Cleveland compare to real Cleveland?
Yes.
Cleveland is a wonderful place to live. It's beautiful. And where Harvey lived, Cleveland Heights, is one of the most beautiful places in Cleveland. He lives nearby a place which they kind of referred to as Millionaire's Row, where, like on Fairmount Boulevard, just a half a mile from where he lived, they have several miles of mansions, each of which is probably, would go for $2 or $3 million, and beautiful landscaping everywhere. And Harvey, when he lived in the apartments, he lived in one of the crappiest apartment buildings that could be found in the entire city. But, you know, he probably did a lot of, you know, hunting to find that. But but when he moved to his new environs, which is where he lived when you guys worked with him, he lived next door to a fellow who was a conductor for the Cleveland Orchestra. And, you know, the houses around there probably, you know, sell for $400,000 or more now.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say it is exactly an upper class place, but it's a very liberal community and there's a lot of beauty to be seen there. And, you know, I think when they made the American Splendor movie, they had a lot of trouble hunting for sites and scenarios that would match his kind of loser city view of Cleveland, you know. I mean, it's not a perfect town, but, you know, I mean, I'm just a huge fan of Cleveland.
So that's why they ended up shooting in Lakeside, Lakeville. I remember reading that the filmmakers had trouble finding areas of Cleveland that matched, you know, the areas that he lived in when he was starting out in the 70s and 80s. So they ended up shooting in Lakeville. Is that the name of the...
Well, you know, you got a good point there. A lot of the film was sort of a flashback. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, suggest that the filmmakers were you know, trying to caricature the city. They may have been trying to capture the city during some of the worst times, because it did go through kind of a depression,
sure,
which had for the most part passed by the time I moved to Cleveland.
Right, right.
Okay, so I wanted to move on to the question about how much liberty Harvey gave me.
Well, I want to hear that for sure, but I also just wanted to establish for our listeners how much Harvey trusted and enjoyed working with you, because I have like a short list of your credits here, and it looks like you have 46 credits with him, starting in American Splendor number 10 in 1985 and going all the way up to the Dark Horse era in 1997. And then you had one more story in our movie year as well. So there was like a good 12-year period where you were one of his totally regular recurring artists.
Yeah, and that's, of course, me and Gary Dumm.
Right.
You know, I mean, I worked with Gary Dumm on virtually every project. And Gary was in the first issue, and I think he was in, I think he worked with Harvey right through the end. And
yeah, I think he has the record for most credits with Harvey, for sure. But he was inking your pencils on most of those stories.
Right, right. But I think I just want to, you know, to the degree that that work looked good was because of Gary's involvement and his professionalism. But anyways, getting to the question of the kind of liberty Harvey gave me, because this is something I enjoy talking about, because in some cases I just blew my mind. Well, I give you an example of a story that I did for him called Easter Island.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look over that story, it seems a lot different than a lot of the other stories that Harvey did. And a lot of the reason is that it was, there was like a lot of gaps in it. He was sort of telling a story that was partially from a letter from an old girlfriend of his. And he really just let me do my own thing in interpreting that. And like, there's entire pages with no dialogue. There's one page with no dialogue and only two depictions of the characters in the story. It like shows, you know, the sun and some flowers. And it's sort of a Carlos Castaneda type of effect for these scenes. And he, you know, he just let me go with it to try to interpret them. And then as to the title of the story, at the very end of the story, after all of the dialogue, et cetera, was done, I put a final panel that showed the idols in Easter Island and some explorers walking by. And so Harvey's looking over the pencils and he comes to this and he says, "Okay, Joe, what's this stuff from Easter Island all about?" and I say to him, "Well, you know, Easter Island was mentioned in the dialogue." And he says, "Oh, okay." And he pauses for a few seconds and he says, "Well, tell you what, how about if we title the story Easter Island?"
That's so cool.
I'm looking at the splash page right now. It's a beautiful first page. We have a close up of a hand digging to a jar full of nuts and screws, and then there's a establishing shot of what looks to be like, is it a Native American?
Yeah, yeah.
With some cars and like a canyon and cactus, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean you can be sure Harvey's you know script didn't say show close-up of hand digging into a jar full of bolts. I don't remember where that came from, but...
Well, you're a storyteller. You know, as an artist and a writer, obviously, you're also a writer. You know, when Josh and I talk about the different artists that have worked with Harvey, I felt the more successful stories were the ones that were drawn by artists that were also writers.
I think that's true. I think in some cases, it's a question of how engaged Harvey is too, of course.
True.
Well, I don't know. I can't think of an artist whose work for Harvey I was not satisfied with. So I, you know.
Well, he was good to collaborate with. So, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He obviously had his insight into, you know, from drawing stick figures that talked to then working with an artist that would then interpret that. There was a give and take there, of course.
Right.
You know?
Right. And by the time I started working with him, he had already had a lot of experience with a lot of artists. So, you know, he was not easily shocked. He knew how to let go and also how to exert control.
Yes.
Yeah, I was struck by what you were saying about how when, you know, by working with him and sort of just imbibing his approach to writing, you know, that really influenced the kind of stuff that you wanted to end up doing. Because I felt very much the same way, that getting to illustrate his stories was like a masterclass in writing memoir, and also just being unexpected in your writing and kind of not just following the formulaic route, you know, looking for other ways mm-hmm. to tell nonfiction stories. So that was really interesting to hear that you kind of had a similar feeling about working with him.
Yeah. Another thing with Harvey that I'm sure you guys encountered at one time or another is he was not particularly interested in making a proper comic book story. He was interested in telling whatever it is he wanted to tell. And in some cases, that meant, you know, a super amount of text and dialogue.
Yes.
And one of the interesting challenges with Harvey was figuring out how to create dynamic pages with all of this text. Mm-hmm. And that's something I really enjoyed a lot, and finding new ways of doing that and stuff. Like, well, an example, it's not exactly an example of too much heavy text, but of just general weirdness, is in A Step Out of the Nest, Harvey devotes like an entire page to discussing what the calendar of events was going to be, you know, how he was going to schedule this trip to New York. And he just goes on and on and on about it, mm-hmm. you know. And I'm looking at this. And so what I decided to do was to have as a background just like a big calendar, and have Harvey's disembodied figure kind of walking around the calendar.
I remember that story. You know? Yeah.
You know, I mean it was sort of a fun way of trying to solve a huge problem. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, if I had just had a head with him thinking all this stuff, you know, I'm sure I would have totally lost the audience.
Right.
But do you think that he would have been happy with that? I always felt like...
Yeah, he wouldn't have.
I felt like Harvey would have been fine.
Yeah. He was... I think he was more or less tolerant of the, you know, kind of artsy things that a lot of us were doing, you know.
But that's because we were being challenged by... I remember I would get a script and I would be like, how am I going to visualize this? Because, you know, there wasn't a lot of art direction, you know? So... You had to depend on your skill set at the time. And then later on, when we brought American Splendor to Vertigo, thankfully I had, you know, the carte blanche to be able to choose a story, because you'd write a bunch of scripts, send it to the editor. And then I'd ask the editor, can I read some of the scripts? Because rather than him assign it to me, I would ask if I could choose a script. And there'd be ones I wouldn't want to draw and ones I would.
Oh, yeah. That sounds good. I can't remember if I ever had that sort of a thing. I think there was a few cases where Harvey gave something to me because he thought that it would meet my skills and stuff. Actually, there was one story that, as far as I can tell, he actually wrote for me. There was a story I had done. One of my first stories for him had this little scene where he was making himself a peanut butter sandwich. And I did it like from first person perspective. So, you know, you saw his hand in the sandwich and, you know, I did it up, you know, tried to make it as interesting as possible. And he really, really liked that scene. Mm. So he wrote this one page script called Making Lemonade.
Yeah.
And had me illustrated. It wasn't strictly speaking a first person perspective, but it was just a story about the making of the lemonade, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been one of my favorites that I did for him, because, you know, it showed very vividly the moment to moment worldview that he sometimes engaged in, you know, of just, well, this is what I did on this particular day. This is what I did for these 5 minutes, you know, and whether or not it's really important or not is kind of beside the point. You know, what it's important because it's part of his life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was totally into that philosophy, and you know, I tried to exemplify that whenever I could in the work.
It's funny, I never thought of that story as kind of like an existential piece. I often have used that story as an example of like, and he even wrote comics about making lemonade, you know, and almost because it's almost an anti-story, it's anti-superhero. Yeah. It's just making lemonade. And that he had the balls not only to write a story about making lemonade, but ask someone to draw that. And yet it's kind of amazing because it's one of the ones that sticks out for me.
Well, you know, well, out
of
all the
stories. He actually did a follow up to that called Peeling and Eating a Tangerine and Disposing of the Seeds that Joe Sacco illustrated. So I remember
That's
it was
right.
like
wow.
something he, you know, he was sticking to that tried and true method of obsessive ordinary life details.
Well, yeah. And let me link that to another story I did for him, which is personally my favorite. It's called Basketball.
Uh-huh.
And it was done for Dark Horse as a back cover, full color.
Yes.
And, you know, just like with Making Lemonade, that's a story about a very simple activity. He's just shooting baskets. But the final thought balloon in it and some flashbacks that I was able to, that he let me put in there. I'm pretty sure that I just thought of putting these flashbacks in there. But it kind of illustrated that this simple action was kind of a summation of, you know, of his life after our cancer year.
Mm-hmm.
That he had recovered the ability to do a little bit of light athleticism, you know, and at the same time, you know, the entire year or 2 years before that was still present in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So when he gave me that script and told me I could do it as a back cover, I just, you know, I just tried so hard to fulfill
mm-hmm.
what he had given me there. And it was really thrilling.
I'm looking at it right now, Joe, and it's a beautiful 9-panel grid painted, I believe.
Right.
I don't think
acrylic.
You were doing digital art. Yeah, acrylic.
Yeah.
It's, you see a basketball, and if you had no idea who Harvey Pekar was, it still works really well because you see this man playing basketball, but it's contrasted with two moments of that same man in, you know, a flashback gray tone in a hospital bed, crawling up the stairs,
mm-hmm.
in contrast with the basketball, you know, getting into the hoop, and then him saying, never thought I'd be able to do that again.
Yeah.
And you totally know what he's talking about if you've never read American Splendor or knew this person ever. It absolutely works on its own. It's a beautiful piece.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And it was a beautiful script to work from. I'm sure Harvey's written better scripts, but I can't put my finger on one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember like what you showed him to get him to hire you as one of his artists? Like, you know, what process, or interview or whatever, like once you got up those stairs and he took care of that $5 bill, like what was that interview like?
Well, you know, I don't think it was a long interview, but I was doing kind of science fiction fantasy type stuff at the time, not generic stuff. It was pretty realistic science fiction and fantasy, you know, ghost stories and things like that. And, you know, I think he saw from the style that it was somewhat realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And he explained to me that what he was looking for was realistic art. And he asked me if I could do something that was realistic. And I said, sure, I can do that. And he asked me to do a sample of something that was drawn in a really realistic style.
Mm-hmm.
So I went home and I found a photograph of Robert Blake, the actor, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
and I did an ink drawing based on that photograph, you know, and tried to make it as realistic as possible. And I showed it to him and he said, okay, yeah, I think you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, you just said Robert Blake and then I just start to imagine Robert Blake in an American Splendor movie playing Harvey, and he totally could have played Harvey.
Yeah.
Do you think that was part of the reason why you chose Robert Blake?
I have no idea. I think it just happened to, you know, I probably had an issue of TV Guide and there was a photo of him. I mean, you remember, this is when before there was the internet. So, you know, you couldn't exactly, mm-hmm. you know, my work would have been so much better if I'd had the internet back then so I could have done research.
Well, let me ask you this. So you show them your artwork and it's got like a sci-fi slant. You have to prove that you can draw more realistically. Uh-huh. But were these pencils you were showing or pencils and inks and finishes? Like,
oh, yeah, it was inked. As a matter of fact, the first story I did for Harvey, I inked it. And I think shortly after that, I think I also inked Making Lemonade.
Okay.
But at some point shortly into my career with Harvey, I guess I must have been discussing it with Gary, and I can't remember specifically how I started working with Gary as the inker, but I was really glad that I did, because for one thing, you know, he is a very smooth and accurate and interesting inker, and he's a very good letterer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he's also a great guy. By working with him, I had the audience of somebody who really knew comics well to show what I was trying to do, you know, and he would get excited about it just like I was. And of course, you know, working with another artist, I was able to be a lot more productive than I would have on my own.
Sure. Right. So did you use photos at all as reference, like the way some of the other artists did, like famously Jerry Shamray?
Well, certainly not like Jerry Shamray did, but I, you know, I always try to get the best references I can. I mean, I probably would use more photos, except for the fact that I'm really lazy. But, you know, what you do is, the best thing is to create like a little style sheet where you try to get, if it's a real person, of course, it's fairly easy to get photos of them, and then you know, use those photos to create a style sheet of drawings from different angles. Mm-hmm. If you're creating a completely fictitious character, then it's a little bit harder to do that. And in some cases, I would take one photograph of somebody and then try to draw them from different angles just using that same photograph. And, you know, that's... not necessarily the most accurate way of doing it, but, you know, as you get more experienced, I guess you develop, you know, some sort of an internal sense of three-dimensionalizing something so you can turn it around in your head.
Mm-hmm. But the fact that you lived in Cleveland and Harvey lived in Cleveland, were you able to, like, be in regular contact with him and see him when you needed to, or, like, meet people that were going to be in his comics, or did you guys take advantage of that proximity to make it easier for you to illustrate stories?
Well, it was certainly that was a big factor in why I got kind of the lion's share of American Splendor stories for a while is, you know, I actually lived two blocks from Harvey.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But you have to understand, Harvey, he was kind of, I guess you could say, an introverted or I don't know exactly how to put it, you know, but he was not a great talker or he had a little bit of difficulty dealing with folks who didn't have, you know, his kind of background,
mm-hmm.
you know. And since I was not a jazz music fan and I'm somebody who's read a fair amount of literature, but you know, God, nothing compared to Harvey. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, let me tell you a little story. One time I found this book at like a book sale. I just bought it because, you know, it was kind of thick. And I thought, well, you know, it's cheap. I might want to read this one of these days. And so I had it on my shelf. And Harvey and Gary were over at my house. We were discussing some sort of a project or something. And I just happened to pluck this book off the shelf. I don't know why I did it. I handed it to Harvey and I said, have you ever read that book? And wow, he knew all about that book. He had, you know, he not only read it, he was like an expert on the author and everything. You know, I mean, Harvey, I guess he was married to an English professor for a while, and he got really obsessed with the idea of being kind of an expert on world literature, mm-hmm. you know, and to the point where he just obsessively read everything.
Yeah.
And not only just read everything like a dork, I mean, he read it, you know, with a very critical, intelligent and kind of a stubbornly outsider kind of perspective. But anyways, I mean, you know, frankly, he was just way beyond me in terms of, you know, he was a genius, mm-hmm. you know, and so the degree to which I could, you know, socialize with him in a normal fashion, I think was kind of limited by that.
Hmm. Josh, did you have another question?
Yeah, well, I definitely want to start talking about the film and
right.
the fact that there were a lot of stories that you worked on that sort of worked their way into the movie in different ways. Should we just jump onto that?
Sure.
Okay. I was just remarking that sort of with about episode 20 and onward, a lot of your work starts showing up in various ways. And episode 20 is what we call What Kind of Girl Is Your New Bride, which is the one with Toby and Harvey in the car together as Toby's getting ready to go see Revenge of the Nerds. And right before that, there were some panels from a Joe Sacco story and then some panels from Passport to Pimlico that you illustrated from American Splendor number 14, 1989. And those are actually shown on screen, like, because there's like a montage of stuff related to Harvey and Joyce's marriage and sort of the rocky road that was. And then in the next episode, there's some more stuff from that story. And then, of course, the big one is you effed up a great thing, which was the scene where Harvey sort of self-immolates on David Letterman. And of course, your story, My Struggles with Corporate Corruption and Network Philistinism, was a great mm-hmm. source for that story. And I was just interested in how you felt about seeing some of the work that you had such a direct hand in showing up in the movie. And I guess just a general question of, were you consulted at all? Were you around when the filming was happening, or just sort of your general experiences as the film was going in production?
Yeah, well, I wasn't consulted in any ways. And I think I met the filmmakers at one shooting that took place at Collector's Warehouse. But in general, the material that was used in the movies was not only it was not only sourced from the comics. I mean, obviously the videotape of the David Letterman show was
sure
the source for that. And one other story that I remember was originally by me that was used in the movie was the story where he's waiting in line at Bernie Shulman's, and there's a kind of an obnoxious woman in line in front of him. And that particular story was, I'm pretty sure it was in the American Splendor play. And I think the version that, I think that was the jumping off point for using it in the movie, was that it worked in the play.
I'm not remembering that scene. Remind me about that scene in the movie.
Well, I thought it was in there. That he's standing in line at Bernie Shulman's, and there's a woman in front of him who, I guess, gets into an argument with the cashier, and Harvey gets very impatient.
Oh, that was standing behind old Jewish ladies in supermarket lines? Because that story was illustrated by Crumb originally.
Well, you know, maybe there was, I know there was one that I illustrated that was that subject matter. Maybe there were two stories and I got the two mixed up.
Well, I do know that Harvey occasionally would repeat himself and do like another story with a different artist illustrating it. So that's interesting. So it sounds like you illustrated a story that was remarkably similar in context to that story that he did with Crumb back in the 70s. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And you know, I sometimes am not as aware of those early issues mm-hmm. either, but Okay, well, you know, well, that could explain it then, why the scenario seemed different than what I illustrated. So.
And what did you say your story took place where? Because that was in a supermarket. Where was yours?
It was in a Bernie Shulman's. It was a sort of a five and dime style discount store.
Oh.
Like Woolworth.
Yeah,
okay.
But it was only in Cleveland.
Oh, interesting.
Got it.
Yeah, and I actually snuck into Bernie Shulman's and took a bunch of photographs and tried to, you know, meticulously show what the shopping carts looked like. Well, anyways, so well that's an interesting revelation that I, you know, that may have, you know, apparently was a completely different story.
Yeah, but like I said, and Jeff Newell talked about this a little, there were times that Harvey told the same story, but told it slightly differently and had a different artist work on it. And as far as he was concerned, it was a whole new interpretation and a nuanced, you know, revisiting of something.
It's like jazz, you know, it's like a variation on a theme, you know.
Yeah.
I think just like with, you know, lemonade or peeling an orange, mm-hmm. or peanut butter sandwich, he would find a theme that he would riff off of and do variations
exactly.
on. Yeah, well, that sounds interesting. Although it shows kind of an unhealthy obsession with, you know, how annoying old Jewish women are. But,
well, as he said, I'm a Yid myself, so I'm allowed to say these things.
That's
so
right.
What did you think of the movie?
Oh, I thought it was fabulous. I mean, it was certainly enough that it was just an attempt to capture American splendor. But then on top of that, it was, you know, an innovative avant-garde movie in its own right, you know, with, you know, this idea of showing the real Harvey and the real Joyce and the real Toby, mm-hmm. you know, side by side with the actors playing them and, you know, a movie within a movie. And, you know, it was certainly an experience.
Yeah.
You know, certainly did him proud.
One thing that I just remembered too is, you know, we spoke to Val Mayerik and interviewed him, and he mentioned specifically that you were the guy that sort of greased the wheels for him to start working with Harvey as well. And he had a very similar take on Harvey's work overall and said similar things when we asked him if he ever socialized with Harvey, about just being that they were, like you said, I mean, I think you said it more succinctly, that he had trouble maybe finding much to talk about with people who didn't share his exact same interests.
Yeah, yeah. And also Harvey, he was a different sort of person behaviorally. You know, I think he told me he worked on a story about a fellow who had Asperger's. I don't know if he ever published it. I wasn't keeping track of his later stuff, but he showed the script to me and we talked a little bit about me doing it, but, you know, it never came to anything with me. But what struck me was that he thought that he himself might have had some kind of Asperger's syndrome. Mm.
I have a feeling a lot of artists and sort of savant types have something about that to them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We're all on the spectrum a little bit.
Harvey was autodidactic. He was an extreme case of the autodidactic person. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, learning everything about literature, learning everything about jazz music to the point where, you know, he was an editor of a jazz music encyclopedia,
mm-hmm.
you know, while just kind of living as a file clerk in Cleveland, you know, I mean,
it's amazing.
Yeah. He was a very interesting character.
He liked being an expert, I believe. Like, that's something I learned drawing The Quitter. If he wasn't really great at something, he didn't want to do it at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So after you worked with him so intensively for like 12 years, and then you kind of started going off and doing some of your own work and your own writing and self-publishing. Was that why you sort of stopped working with him? Or was it just sort of like you felt like you'd exhausted the possibilities with him? Or,
well, I thought I needed to get on with my artistic life and with, you know, trying to develop my own voice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had spent so much time working with Harvey and really couldn't do much in addition to that, that I thought it was important to make the big leap.
Mm-hmm.
Did Harvey encourage that?
Well, I wouldn't say so. No, that would have been thinking about others.
Oh,
that's no, true. Harvey was very generous, but you know, I don't think that he worked with a lot of artists. I don't think he had a very strong sense of how a particular artist's career or life was mm-hmm. going, you know?
Yeah. I don't want to sound like sour grapes, cause I don't think any of us feels that way, but it's funny cause after you did your story, how the night I met Harvey Pekar, and then I was thinking about how Jerry Shamray did a similar story about how he started working with Harvey, that there's almost like this club developing of former artists who are finally like telling their side of the story.
Yeah. Survivors.
Yeah. And I was just thinking, like, it's funny that Harvey never mentioned, like, in the back page of every comic, he could have easily had a little section of short bios of each of the contributors to that issue, you know, with each of us drawing our little headshot or something. Like, that wouldn't have been an unexpected or unusual thing to do. But that just was never uh-huh. part of his agenda. It was very much like we were his tools. And it was his copyright and these were his stories. And, you know, it is worth acknowledging that, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's true to some extent that we weren't, you know, like his life companions or his best buddies. But on the other hand, he was very loyal and conscientious.
Mm-hmm.
For example, he got a commission to do a story called An Almost All Expense Paid Vacation. It was a commission for, I think it was Preview Magazine or one of these other magazines that was covering the motion picture industry. You know, it was like a really big deal. This was like a while after I had stopped working regularly on American Splendor.
Mm-hmm.
He threw that to me and to Gary because it was a good paying gig. You know, it would get seen by a lot more people than your usual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have given it to somebody else, you know, that was working with him at the time, you know, or ask somebody at Dark Horse to give him like a really slick professional artist who'd, you know, worked on for Marvel or DC or something.
Right.
But, you know, he gave it to us because of the fact that, you know, he was grateful to us for all the work we've done for him. And, you know, he was kind of paying back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time, he knew that we would do our absolute best for it. And, you know, and of course we did, gave it our best shot.
Totally.
So
yeah, that's one of the reasons why the quitter happened was because I helped make the introductions for the movie to Ted Hope, the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd only drawn like three or four, like one or two page American Splendor stories at the time. And he said, as a thank you, he said, what do you want, you know, as a thank you? And I said, I'd like to do something more substantial with you. And that's what turned out to be the quitter at DC Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, that was definitely a privilege for you. And, you know, I imagine it puts you in a position of being one of the foremost experts on this guy.
Yeah, who knew, right? Hey, did you ever get to meet like R. Crumb or any of the other artists? I mean, obviously you worked with Gary Dumm.
I met Frank Stack. I may have met some other artists that I don't remember. And I met some of his jazz musician friends, but you know, not a whole lot of that. You know, I mostly stayed in Cleveland, you know, and that was it.
Right.
Oh, and I met Toby. Does that count?
Sure.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Harvey invited me to go to a signing with him in I think it was Toronto, and the arrangement was that me and Toby would drive up there, and Harvey was going some other way. I think maybe he was taking a plane or something like that. So I got to spend an entire good three quarters of a day driving with Toby up to Toronto.
That must have been an experience.
It was. Toby is a fascinating guy. Did you know that Toby He was a member of a club that was involved in kind of refurbishing and working with old computer models, like, you know, like your Atari and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
His club, they would circulate games that had been written for these old machines and stuff. And I bring this up not just because it's an odd fact, but because, you know, that requires a pretty high degree of technical knowledge and understanding to even participate in a club like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Toby was actually very smart, but also, you know, I mean, he was another person who I guess you could say he has Asperger's. I'm not sure technically,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's obviously psychologically very different than other people, but also a very nice guy too.
Yeah, we actually just talked to him last week for the show. And then today we actually spoke to Judah Friedlander, the actor who plays him. So
wow.
We're like, at this point, the world experts on Toby Radloff.
Wow, you guys are really putting a lot into this.
Well, it's all for our own benefit and self-aggrandizement, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I think I've pretty much covered the questions that I had. Dean, did you have any of your patented follow-ups?
A question I like to ask is, what do you miss most about Harvey Pekar?
I definitely miss the challenge of every new script. They were all great scripts to work with. You know, I guess what I was partly missing when I worked with him was the kind of scripts that he wrote before he started going on the David Letterman show and becoming a celebrity. Because I worked on a number of pieces that he wrote after he'd become a celebrity. And, you know, it just wasn't the same. And I kind of miss those more innocent pieces, you know, when he was just totally on his own, completely unknown in Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, but, you know, I mean, that's my personal perspective. I mean, someday somebody's going to do an assessment of his work from a serious literary standpoint. I don't think that's been done yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect that early American Splendors, and I would say maybe the later American Splendor, the mature assessment with stories like The Quitter, you know, is going to be what holds up the best. And this stuff like A Step Out of the Nest, of course, which I put my heart and soul into, but I don't think it's on the same level as the other work. You know?
Oh, that's interesting. I always had a theory that his work sort of went down a little bit after he retired, because I felt like so much of the excellence and sort of the epiphanous stories came out of his interactions with people at work and the various characters, and just sort of, you know, his exposure to all sorts of different people and different situations like really helped his stories. But that's interesting that you perceived a difference also between, you know, before Letterman and after Letterman. That's very interesting.
Well, thank you. I wanted to make a closing comment that would be interesting. And
you did.
People will be thinking about it for weeks to come.
I also, if I may, I know we're sure. ending, we're wrapping this up, but I had never actually considered Harvey an introvert. And now that you mention it, because I know introverts and I recognize it a little bit better now, I think there's some merit to that. And then it makes me reconsider something I've thought about Harvey. Is that I thought of him as a person that would be the kind of guy that could sit on the stoop and talk to anybody. But maybe that's not the case. Maybe, you know, the way he connected with people was through the stuff that he loved. And if you didn't love what he loved, he might not have any time for you or wouldn't know how to negotiate with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe he was a different kind of person at different parts of his life, too. You know, like some people are, the high school is the best time of their life. And,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they get out of high school and they suddenly think, well, now I'm a loser.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas some people mature more later in life and like that. I think there apparently was a time when Harvey did just hang out on the street corner with his buddies and tell these kind of stories, you know. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, maybe he made up that, you know, to account for why he was telling these stories. I don't
sure.
know.
Well, I always thought he was acutely observational. Like this that's the thing I learned most from him is observation, his ability to observe and to try to create the verisimilitude of authenticity in his comics to such a degree that he kind of became a master at it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why you pick up a story by Harvey Pekar is you know that's going to have that authenticity, you know?
Yeah, but it's generally authenticity about himself and his own feelings.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are some characters that he observes well, especially like in the classic American Splendor, like Mr. Boats and Toby.
Yeah.
And later on there, I don't think there's as much of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more about his reaction to things and people.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Well, before we sign off, is there anything you want to tell us about what you've been up to or you want to hip people to in terms of, you know, recent publications or any of that sort of stuff?
Well, let me just try in a nutshell to say what I've been doing. You know, I was very heavily into comics for many years and into web comics. And I also the subliminal tattoos type experience. I did something called the Webcomics Examiner, which was like a crazy, you know, I was very heavily into webcomics, writing about them as well as drawing them. And then I kind of dropped out of comics altogether, and I focused on working on paintings and working on written fiction
mm-hmm.
for 7 or 8 years at least. Now, more recently, I've kind of slowly worked my way back into comics, and I'm working on a comics anthology now. It's going to be full color and kind of in the style of that one pager that I sent you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm really totally engaged in it. I really am eager to get back in, you know, and so.
That's really exciting because we both, Dean, I think you and I can speak for you that we really loved that piece and the energy of it and sort of how it's a little bit of a different spin on the Joe Zabel that we know from 15 years ago.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And I look forward to what you're doing here, Joe. I'm really excited that you're coming back to comics.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure you guys get my first anthology when it comes
Can't
out.
Wait.
It's gonna, the title is Emperor Tom.
Ooh. Emperor Tom.
Yep.
Wow.
And do you have any websites or other social media handles that you want to let anybody know about?
Oh, yeah. JoeZabel.com. Yeah. I have trouble keeping up with it. I think I might drop a little blog spot saying that, you know, that I did this interview and then when it publishes it. But, you know, I'm just not as much of an internet person as I used to be. But I do have a website out there with some things.
Awesome. Well, Dean, any last thoughts?
No, it was great to catch up with you, Joe, after all these years. I feel like the last time I saw you was probably at Small Press Expo like eons ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm planning on going back there sometime, although I don't know how I'm going to get in because you can't exactly get a table anymore unless you, I guess.
Yeah, it's tough.
You have to be under 25 and have like 10 tattoos and sell lots of little handmade prints. But
that
have
nothing to do with story, right?
Yeah, but I went to the Space Convention this year.
Yeah, I've heard that's a great show.
And there's a small Pekar convention that's held in the Coventry Peace Park in Cleveland Heights in July. I was at that.
Wait, there's a regular recurring Pekar convention?
Yeah.
How do we not know about this, Dean?
I have never heard of that.
I will make sure that you know about it from now on. Yeah.
Oh,
but
my
it's
God.
Very,
I'm gonna have to Google
very
that.
Small. I don't know. Where are you guys centered?
We're both in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah, it's kind of a long drive from Brooklyn for this tiny little micro convention, but
that's so cool.
For me, it's like almost walking distance to get there, so it's super cool for me.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to investigate that and maybe make a connection with those folks. Very cool. Well, Joe Zabel, thank you so much for being on Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, guys. It was a privilege and a lot of fun.